Let's begin.
Hello and welcome to Pods Above Replacement, part of the Padres Hot Tub Podcast Network. My name is Rafe Cantor. I am the producer of Padres Hot Tub, and joining me from the Mile High City, he's stranded in scoring position. It's John Fricoda.
Would somebody please just drive me in? Please. Please, somebody. At least move me over. I need to get home.
Yeah, you're like a kid standing outside school and parent just forgot to come pick them up, you know? That's what the runners in scoring position have been like for the Padres in the month of May.
I think it might be sadder.
So honestly, sadder. So, if you could figure it out by now, we are reviewing the San Diego Padres for the month of May. Wanted to get this in on Memorial Day weekend since that's a kind of a traditional tentpole in the baseball season. So we will get started in just a second. But before we do, John and I are prolifically bad at plugging things we need to plug at the start of episodes. So we're going to do that now. First of all, we hope you're watching us on YouTube. Specifically, if you have the YouTube Music app, this is a fun little thing that John has pointed out to myself, which is that if you have the YouTube Music app, you can listen to our show, you know, walking around in your pocket. You don't have to be looking at it. And then if we are talking about something, as we're wont to do, that has data that we're referencing, that has visuals and stuff, we say, we hope you're watching on YouTube for this, you can just pull out your phone and it's right there. It's like, it's caught up for you. So that's a phenomenal thing. We recommend watching the show on the YouTube Music app if you have it. And if not, download it because it's a piece of cake. On top of that, we hope you're subscribed. Guys, we've been doing this for a couple months. We already have over 500 subscribers. We are growing at a phenomenal pace. And once we get to 1,000 subscribers, that's when things really start to change for us from a YouTube partnership standpoint. So it's a critical number for us. So we're hoping you can help us get there. So like, subscribe, comment, etc. And last but not least, you know, we put out some stat explainer videos. We broke down WAR, WOBA, and WRC+, three of the stats we reference most on our show. A few people have seen them, but I know a lot of our audience hasn't yet. So if you have any questions about those stats, you know, want to dig more into those, understand, you know, what this whole sabermetric thing is about, if you're new to the show, new to kind of the advanced stat world, please check out those episodes. They are on our page. So without further ado, John, please, what has been going on in May? Will you please tell us where we stand?
May. So where we stand, it's not in a place that makes us all happy, I don't think. We're now, as of this recording, which is basically the beginning of the Yankees game on Saturday, 24 and 27, 6.5 games out of first. We are 2.5 games out of a wild card position, and just a few games, 2.5 games out of being very last place in the NL. So things have not started off well. Something that I would like to point out is our record does not seem to match how well we've played. It does seem as though we've been a little bit unlucky, not insanely unlucky, but unlucky. Our run differential is only -1, which would suggest that we're probably closer to a 500 team so far this year in terms of how well we've played, but we're 3 games under. And in addition to that, we are 3-8 in one-run ball games and 0-4 in extra inning games, which is a huge discrepancy from how last year we were, which was 30-17 in one-run games and 12-5 in extra innings games. So, I mean, if you just even get a 500 result out of those like one-run games and those extra inning games, once again, you're adding another about 3 wins to our ledger and putting us to a more comfortable, probably like 27-24, which I think that folks would be a lot more reticent to complain if we were sitting at 27-24. Still complain, probably, but a little bit less, I would imagine. And so that's intriguing or exciting in a little manner. You can say, you know, we're not as bad as we have played, or at least as bad as our record shows. And so, you know, you can expect regression to the mean. That being said, we've played 500 baseball, but we're 3 games under 500, and regression to the mean does not mean that we had bad luck, so now we're going to have good luck. It just means that we haven't been as bad as we've been in the past, so you can't just expect us to make up that three-win differential. We are 3 wins behind where we should be, and that's just going to be the case going forward. So our ending record, if we're, you know, make it to 90 wins, you could say, yeah, but if we just would have played like we should have played, we could have had, you know, 3 more wins than that at the end of the year.
Yeah. So like John said, we've been playing 500 baseball, but the way we've been playing 500 baseball is, let's just say, an example of extremes. The very short thesis, if you were to, you know, stop watching the episode now, which, dear God, please don't, because we are about to get into some crazy stuff. But the thesis is pitching. Really good. Fielding, really good. Offense, so bad. So, like, poopy butthole offense for the entire month of May. Okay.
And not as funny. Not as funny as Mr. Poopy Butthole.
Not as funny as Mr. Poopy Butthole at all. So, with that in mind, we're going to start with the bad. We're going to start with the offense. Because there's no, you know, we'd be dancing around the biggest elephant in the room if we started anywhere else. The team has, we're going to come up with a lot of really fancy ways of saying the team hasn't been hitting, but the team hasn't been hitting, and we're going to break down sort of the why of that. The headline numbers in the month of May, they were 27th in the league in both batting average and slugging percentage. The only teams that were worse were the Pittsburgh Pirates, who, if you want to talk about regression of the mean, they are experiencing it. The potentially historically terrible Oakland Athletics, and shockingly, I will say the Cleveland Guardians, who, you know, mind you, I would suspect are will be a good team and will compete for their division and et cetera. They play in a much weaker division than we do. But at the same time, you know, for all of the strengths of the Guardian organization, they do not have a $250+ million payroll. And we do. And we are drastically, drastically underperforming the expectations of what we'd be having. So a team average of 219 so far in May and a team slug of 370. Not great. Something that we talked about in the April episode. The team is walking a ton. And, you know, of course, that is an indicator of approach. They have a team walk rate of 12.2%, which is well above, any other teams. And that is not an accident. You know, their K rate is in the upper half of the league. It's not, you know, they're not striking out like at an insane rate. You definitely, favor their walk to strikeout rate, I think, is still among the league leaders. But the issue is that they're not swinging the bat. They're not swinging the bat. I need to skip in my notes a little bit, just down to overall swing percentage. And this is for the entire season so far. This isn't just the month of May. But the team has the third lowest swing percentage in baseball. Now, that's not inherently bad. Having a low swing percentage is actually pretty good. You know, like it's the thing that, John, you've brought up before, that Kyle Bodhi and the Driveline folks talk about, which is that people swing too much in baseball. It is so valuable to take balls that it behooves you to swing less than you do. But it's important to swing when you're supposed to swing. And that's the issue, is that the Padres have not been swinging when they are supposed to swing. They have the second lowest zone swinging percentage in baseball. So the second lowest swing percentage on pitches inside the strike zone. So if you're not swinging at pitches in the strike zone, you're not able to generate value on those pitches. And you especially want to be swinging at pitches in what's dubbed the heart of the plate. Now, the heart is, StatCast breaks down the strike zone into 4 general macro zones. There's the heart, which is what you'd expect, the middle of the plate. There's the shadow, which is one baseball length inside and outside the edge of the strike zone. And then there's chase pitches, which is further outside of that. And then there's waste pitches, which are way outside. And the Padres in the month of May as a team had an expected WOBA of 360 on pitches right down the middle or in the heart of the plate. Okay. And we talked about WOBA in our last stat explainer episode. You know, 320 is league average. You know, every 20 points you go up is kind of a, another tier. And the thing when you're looking at this, though, is that pitches in the heart of the plate is where you should be putting up, you know, expected WOBA numbers north of 400, because those are pitches that are eminently hittable. And StatCast basically breaks down run values, where they basically say, like, your team has generated run values above or below average. And they assign that based off of, you know, a bunch of different metrics, but we're doing it based off of where the pitches were in the zone here. And for pitches that were in the heart of the plate in the month of May, the San Diego Padres had negative 26 runs compared to average. So the only team that was worse was the Pittsburgh Pirates. Even the lowly Oakland Athletics had a better run value on pitches in the heart of the plate. And if you'll remember from our WAR episode, we talked about runs per win, where basically you can safely say that about 9 or 10 runs a year is how much it's going to take to win a game. Right now, if we're looking at negative 26 run value compared to average in the heart of the plate, that's like 2.5 wins that basically the Padres cost themselves on pitches in the heart of the zone. And if you go down to a player by player breakdown, which again, we hope you're watching on YouTube because we've been putting all of this data on screen so far. And we look at all the players on the Padres, only one player has positive, run value over one run. Okay. And this is for the whole year. Only one player has positive run value greater than one run. It's Juan Soto. And the thing about Juan Soto is he's generating his run value in the chase and waste sections of the zone. He's not generating run value in the heart of the plate. And no one, in fact, is generating significant value in the heart of the plate. I see only Fernando Tatis Jr. and Nelson Cruz have positive value on the whole team for the whole year. So that's bad. That's bad. And to me, it points to a selectiveness that the Padres have that I think has maybe gone past the limit of being effective, you know, where you're being so passive and you're being so selective that, you know, it's not paying dividends for you. And before I hand it back to you, John, this was one of the things where this is a pulling back the curtain a little bit on how we do research for the show. Sometimes I'm just going through StatCast and I'm just like, putting different filters on things. And I'm like, just trying to find patterns. I'm like, this seems interesting. This seems interesting. This seems interesting. Oh, this is probably stupid. This is probably noise, you know? But one of the things that I found interesting in our batted ball profile is that the Padres are dead last in the major leagues in line drive percentage. Dead last. And the issue with that is that line drives are where you generate value because they're the ones that you know are the hardest hit balls typically. They're the ones that are most likely to, you know, land in the field of play and in a position where, you know, the batter will be safe. And I'm kind of intrigued by this because right behind us are the Tampa Bay Rays, who obviously are having an incredibly successful season. But it's something to note because in tandem with the next stat, because not only are they the dead last in the league in line drive percentage, but they also lead the league in getting under balls. And so that to me is another thing where I think we're looking at kind of an overall team approach where obviously we're trying to hit the ball in the air, but we're also not swinging the bat enough. And I'll be curious if we see some evening out of that as the year progresses. But now I think we have enough of a sample size where we can make some sort of broader conclusions about approach. And I think that is certainly one of them, is too passive and trying to get under balls too much to the point where it's not effective. So, John, with all that being said, curious your thoughts. And I know you're going to talk about, one of our erogenous zones here on pods of replacement runners in scoring position.
Yes, I will. But first, just commenting on what you had just gone through is the, you know, our inability to produce runs on pitches down the heart of the plate. And if you think about that from like a strategic standpoint, you kind of want players that generate value in different, you know, manners relative to each other. So Juan Soto, as a player, obviously a superstar, he most of the time generates most of his value from like that chase and waste section of the plate. Like he gets a lot of value from taking walks. And yeah, he'll hit a home run every once in a while, but he doesn't do it in the same fashion as, say, Fernando Tatis Jr., right? Tatis has always, his profile has always been the same, which is he smashes balls down the heart of the plate, and he'll lose a lot of runs on like those shadow pitches and those chase pitches, because you can throw him a slider off the plate and he will chase. So it's kind of that exchange, right? And like classically in the way that lineups have classically been developed is you kind of want those people that generate runs by taking pitches towards the top of the lineup, and then, you know, clean up. The name of that position in the batting order is cleaning the runners up. You kind of want that player to be the one that drives people in. And so lots of times you'll sacrifice maybe pitches per plate appearance in order to have somebody put the ball in play. Because if you put the ball in play, you hit it hard, just BABIP look alone is going to suggest that you're going to, you know, get some, your higher average profile and maybe create more damage on balls down the heart of the plate, for example. And so Juan Soto, like you said, is generating a ton of value. I mean, he's just been very good, obviously, overall, but his profile, he's kind of matched what he always does, which is takes a lot of walks, and once in a while he'll pump one, you know, deep into the right field stands. But if Tatis, who is obviously one of the players that is more likely to swing, and especially Manny Machado, those are the guys you kind of want up with runners on, because they're willing to put the ball in play, and Tatis is willing to put the ball over the fence. So it just shows that we're still getting some of the good value from, you know, people like Soto and Bogarts and Cronenworth, Trent Grisham even. They're all watching pitches and getting value, but who's the guy that's driving everybody in? And the answer is nobody. And so to go into those runners in scoring position stats specifically, the more I look into these runners in scoring position stats, the just funnier it is. Like, it's just hilarious, like in a very dark humor type of way. I know that the stat that everybody is always bringing up is how poor our batting average is with runners in scoring position. And obviously it's terrible. It's last in the league, 186. Nobody else is below 200. Nobody else is below 210 even. So we're, you know, almost 30 points below anybody else in terms of batting average. And I do get the inclination to look at batting average when there's runners in scoring position, because that's the main way you drive people in. But it's not just batting average. We're just terrible in every single capacity you could possibly be terrible in. We are terrible in that capacity with runners in scoring position. Our slash line is 186, 281 OBP, and a 319 slugging, each of which individually is last in the league. We have a WOBA of 269. With runners in scoring position, also last in the league, by a 14-point margin, which is incredible. Like, the A's are in 27th, they're at 287, and then you go down to the Tigers, they're 284, so a little bit lower, and then you go to KC, they're 283, and then you go to us, boom, we're all the way down in 269, 14-point gap after a bunch of just like one-point separations on these terrible teams. So, I mean, we're making the A's, the Tigers, and the Royals look like they're, you know, sluggers up at the plate. We are just god-awful. And it's every single way that you can be bad with runners in scoring position, we are bad with runners in scoring position. And just to put like a number to that, people or hitters this year who have a 269 WOBA are basically players that are like, if they're not getting cut, they're on the verge of getting cut. Like, for example, Eric Hosmer had a 267 WOBA before they cut him. The Cubs did, and the other names are like...
Is he behind me?
I can't see you.
Is he behind me, Eric Hosmer? Oh. No. I think we're good.
He's always on. He's always on. He's my example of just being terrible, and he is... Yeah, obviously he was terrible. He's terrible enough to get cut. And that's just who we are with runners in scoring position. You know, Jake Lamb, Luis Renifo, Ramon Laureano. These are all the guys that we're hitting like whenever there's runners in scoring position. When we have a, you know, bajillion-dollar payroll, we should not be last in every single category when it comes to runners in scoring position. But that's, you know, that's dark humor, whatever. What makes it even more funny to me is that as soon as you filter for no runners in scoring position, so every time that there's not a runner on second or third, suddenly we're 10th in the league in WOBA. We're a couple points behind the Dodgers. It's like, what is happening? You know, like so the Angels, they're at 330. They're seventh in the league. Dodgers, 329. They're eighth. The Rangers, 328. They're ninth. And then we're 326, you know, right there in 10th place, just with the teams that we'd want to be associated with in terms of how well we're hitting. Whenever there's no runners in scoring position, our slash line is 237, 327, and 411, which compares. We went down from Eric Hosmer to more like somebody like Chris Bryant, JT Realmuto, Ozzie Albies, whenever there's not runners in scoring positions. So how is that even possible? How can you hit, 50 points higher? What is that? It's higher than 50 points higher. Yeah, it's like 60 points higher whenever there's nobody on, and then suddenly there's a player on, and you just shut down, I guess. And so I was looking into it in terms of like individual players and like, who are these people that are dropping off so precipitously? And there are a few. So Soto's expected numbers are just the same with runners in scoring position and without runners in scoring position. But he does have a huge drop off in terms of actual results in terms of like WOBA with runners in scoring position. So that I would attribute that more to luck with how the batted ball is for him than anything else. But Xander, he's been, relatively the same with runners in scoring position as without runners in scoring position. Nelly Cruz has been way better with runners in scoring position. Machado has been, bad either way, but, just as good with runners in scoring position. But then it's Ha-Sung Kim, Jake Cronenworth, Fernando Tatis Jr., our black hole of a catcher spot, Matt Carpenter, Trent Grisham, and Austin Nola. All of those players just drop off precipitously so far with runners in scoring position, which, if you recognize those names, it constitutes the majority of the lineup. So it's like, yeah. If Xander, Manny, or Soto is not up with runners in scoring position, or Odor lately, but, whatever. If it's not those specific guys that are up, it's just, we're done. There's no chance that we're going to score runs that inning because everybody is in like the 250 range. And that's Kim, Cronenworth, Tatis, the Sullivan, Anola battery, the Carpenter, Grisham, Azekar was terrible when he was up. That's so many holes in the lineup when it comes to runners in scoring position and people that are just dramatically failing suddenly when those, situations come up. And it's like, what is happening? It has to be, to me, some kind of like mental thing that's just going through our whole lineup.
Yeah, and just really quickly, John, these numbers that we're looking at, which are on screen right now, are these just for the month of May, or are these for the entire season by player running sort of scoring position?
It's for the entire season.
So this is the issue, season, and I want folks to look at this if they're not watching on YouTube right now, because on the stat there is a column that says pitch percentage, which basically means this is the percentage of their overall pitches that they have seen where runners are in scoring position, and Look at the Matt Carpenter number. He's coming to bat a third of the time with runners in scoring position, and he's putting up a 233
look at
WOBA. And that was my next point. Austin Nola is coming up 32.7% of the time with runners in scoring position, and he's putting up a 167 WOBA. Now contrast that with Fernando Tatis Jr., who, by the way, doesn't have great positions with RISP either, but he's only coming up 18.7% of the time. That's what's going to happen when you're batting leadoff. Manny Machado is only coming up 21.7% of the time with runners in scoring position. And Juan Soto, Juan M-effing Soto, is coming up to bat with runners in scoring position 16.5% of the time. There is your issue. It's that your studs are coming up half as much with runners in scoring position as Austin effing Nola, okay? And so if we're wondering why this isn't working, it's because the lineup is completely disjointed. And that being said, I don't expect these numbers to continue. They cannot possibly continue. Like, it's just like, it's that thing of like, what is regression to the mean? You don't want to start believing in some sort of gambler's fallacy where you're like, well, now we're going to get lucky. That's not how it works. But that being said, I mean, these are truly abysmal numbers. But if we don't see the overall lineup construction change and significant, you know, changes being made in the way that we roll out our team, I'm curious whether or not this is going to continue for a prolonged period. So super, super good stuff, John. And I know you wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, the DH spot and, you know, some of the guys we've had circling in and out of there.
Yeah. I mean, you can certainly say that it's not sustainable, and it's not. Those numbers are insane. I mean, how could you be 10th in the league with no runners on scoring position, which is 75% of the time that you're up in general? And then by far, by wide margins, the worst when there suddenly is runners in scoring position. It's got to be mental. However, you do point out just a fantastic point, which is like, do you think that this is not strategy? This is very clearly strategy. Like,
yeah.
Who suddenly has runners in scoring position? As a team, if you have, you know, somebody on second base and Xander's coming up, are you going to pitch to Xander? Or are you going to maybe nibble around Xander and, you know, maybe get him to hit a pitcher's pitch in play? Or if you walk him, whatever. It's Nelly Cruz, it's Matt Carpenter, it's Ha-Sung Kim, it's these folks that are performing extraordinarily poorly with runners in scoring position and getting a ton of opportunities. I mean, Austin Nola hits 8th or 9th in the order and he's getting 32%. It's not like he has a bunch of, you know, great hitters above him. It's that pitchers are probably going, yeah, I mean, Ha-Sung Kim might not be great, but I think that I'd rather pitch to Austin Nola with these runners in scoring position. And it's just like, oh my God, how are you? They're just like targeting. They're doing the Greg Maddux thing where you're like, this is the guy that's not going to beat me, and he never does. So I don't know. It's just been, rough. I'll tell you that. It's getting sadder and sadder. The joke is getting darker and darker every time somebody comes to the plate with runners in scoring position. But yeah, so I want to talk about the DH position, and that's because obviously we have two guys that are kind of platooning in the DH, both of whom very seldom take the actual field, and that's Matt Carpenter and Nelly Cruz. And there was a study, I don't know if you saw this, but Kyle Bodie made a tweet, I think it was yesterday or the day before, that seemed maybe indirectly aimed directly at the Padres. But he mentioned a study, and the study showed that you can attribute possibly 2 wins over the course of an entire season just to having roster flexibility, players that can move around the diamond. And I mean, that's kind of been the Dodgers model for years and years and years. You know, you've seen like Bellinger just go from first to center field. Chris Taylor is just everywhere. Now they're putting Mookie Betts everywhere. It's just part of their DNA, it seems. And it seems like it could have been part of our DNA too. It seems like that's what AJ Preller was going for originally. I mean, he was signing people with versatility. Profar, he originally thought was going to play second, first, and left field. Ha-Sung Kim can play all over the diamond. Now Cronenworth can play all over the diamond. We have a ton of versatility, but we're not really using it. And one of those reasons is because we have 2 roster spots spent on players that basically only play the DH. Every once in a while, Matt Carpenter plays a poor first base. But for the most part, it's just a platoon at the DH spot, taking up 2 whole roster spots, neither of whom are even hitting. Carpenter has an 88 WRC plus and Cruz has an 84 WRC plus. So you're getting below average production from 2 roster spots that have no positional versatility. Now you're talking like, you know, if versatility gives you 2 wins and we're taking completely away any versatility that our roster should technically have with, you know, the players that we have, you're costing them 2 runs plus maybe more from just the inability to hit from those 2 particular players. So it's just so frustrating. And you can see like, us even bringing up Brandon Dixon and him hitting, you know, decently the last couple of weeks to the point that he has a 126 WRC plus overall at this point. His just being able to play first base or play left field or right field, you know, once in a while when you want to like change up the matchups or whatever is valuable. And so now it seems that we have like 3 roster spots spent on what is basically like a first base DH platoon while Manny is out. And it's frustrating because we have the makeup of a team with a lot of versatility, but we just pigeonholed ourselves into not being able to by getting 2 DHs to play, which, by the way, is not something that I think is necessarily a bad idea, having a DH that you have that just only DHs. I just think that it's a better strategy post-trade deadline. Like, you can get a DH at the trade deadline for fairly cheap. And, you know, you spent the whole spring and summer with versatility, keeping guys healthy, rotating guys through. And then if you just want that big bopper for the playoffs when you have basically the same lineup every time, sure, that's a good strategy. But if you do it all year, now we're wasting Cronenworth's ability to move around, Kim's ability to move around. It's just a little bit frustrating to me.
Well, it's been about 20 minutes of pure chaos on this podcast, but I have some good news. Juan Soto is fixed. And some would say, I would say that the host of this podcast would say, Juan Soto was never broken. Juan Soto had a mix of extreme unluckiness and, some small sample size, taking a bite out of the apple. But boy, oh boy, John, the man who we always believed in is back. And just taking a look at the numbers in May, Juan Soto leading the team with a 458 expected WOBA, his actual WOBA even higher, 486. And I think that that's just a little bit of that regression that we were talking about, where he had such an extreme in April of putting up like a 380 expected WOBA and only putting up like a 310 or something like that. So we're seeing kind of that the backwards trend of that. His exact slash line in the month of May so far, 346 with an on-base percentage of 480 and a slug of 630. So that is an 1130 OPS. And, you know, when you look at how that compares to the stars of the game in the month of May, he's right back in that elite company. Aaron Judge, huge outlier. He put up a 544 expected WOBA. Talk about regression, because he was a little bit pedestrian to start the year. But then, you know, Yordan Alvarez, Ronald Acuna Jr., and then Juan Soto in terms of expected WOBA. You'll take that every single time. And, just tying this back to what I was speaking about earlier in terms of pitches over the heart of the plate, you know, that's where you're going to see the most marked improvement for Juan Soto between April and May. You know, in April, in pitches in the heart of the plate, he was slashing 240. I actually don't have his on-base percentage here. He was slashing 240 at a slug of 500. His WOBA was 311, and his expected WOBA was 362. So there's that dissonance I was talking about too. So even though, you know, he was putting up a 362 WOBA, which is expected WOBA, which is really low for Juan Soto on pitches in the heart of the plate, he was still getting, you know, 50 points unlucky in that sample. Now when we look at May, in pitches in the heart of the plate, he's hitting 447 with a slug of 921 and an expected WOBA of 610. His actual WOBA, by the way, 575. So even still, he's a little bit unlucky if it's just the heart of the plate. And when we were talking about expected run value, this is that huge difference that we were talking about. In April, his expected run value was minus 2.9 compared to average. Now it is 4.2 in the plus column. So that swing alone, you know, of, let's see, that's like 7.1 runs. You know, that's three quarters of a win, theoretically, in a swing just in pitches in the heart of the plate. So let's pay attention to that as we go forward. Anything before we move on to pitching, you know, any victory lap that you want to take about Juan Soto, or are you good?
As a bold prognosticator, I took the very bold stance that 24-year-old Juan Soto did not fall off a cliff and suddenly be a bad hitter. And yes, I would like to take a bunch of victory laps for thinking that Juan Soto was still good.
Yeah. Yeah, I was saying to John before we hit record, but there was a Cespedes Family Barbecue tweet last night that basically said, respectfully, if you didn't believe in Juan Soto, that's a you problem. I concur completely with that tweet. So let's talk about pitching. And this is where things get really interesting for the Padres, because the way that they've been hitting feels like how they've been playing. But the way that they've been pitching on paper does not feel like how things have gone, which goes to show you what happens when a team doesn't hit. Because you guys, they were the league leaders in ERA in May, okay? I know we like to get more specific than ERA on the show. We like to break down the nitty-gritty. Like, let's 294. They threw a 294 ERA in the month of May, okay? The next closest team is the Houston Astros with a 319. And then it's like a 320, a 328, a 349. You know, it's like they have a wide gulf between the rest of the league, just in ERA, just in terms of outcomes, in terms of like how they pitched. Second in expected WOBA too. So if we want to pull out the, are they getting like extremely lucky? I mean, like maybe, and we'll talk about that in a second, but not really. Like the quality of content that they've been producing has actually been pretty good from a pitching standpoint. They've had like pretty good outcomes that, and unexpected outcomes. So, you know, if you want to talk about, you know, luck, they had a really low BABIP, 258, but at the same time, as we've mentioned multiple times on the show, BABIP can either point to luck in sample or it can point to really poor quality of contact. So to me, when I see expected WOBA is the second best in the league for the month of May, it makes sense to me why they put up a really low BABIP. It's because players aren't hitting very well against them. They've had a 440 expected FIP. We haven't really talked about expected FIP on the show. We've talked about FIP when we did our WAR episode, which again, just for a reminder for folks, it's fielding independent pitching. And basically, it takes out any ball that's put into the field of play, and it just evaluates pitchers based off of home runs, walks, hit by pitches, and strikeouts. The idea behind that is that it actually shows more of the quality of how a pitcher threw, since balls put into play can just inherently be super random. Now, expected FIP follows that same logic, except instead of home runs, it basically takes the league fly ball to home run rate and uses that as a benchmark for pitchers, because the idea is essentially, you know, if teams are putting up a lot of fly balls, there's going to be some natural variance in terms of how many of those actually go over the fence, you know, based off of the way that the wind was blowing a certain day or what the temperature was or whatever. So it wants to see how many fly balls a team is allowing and then compare that to the league home run fly ball rate, and then uses that as an approximation. And the reason XFIP is cool, in my opinion, is that it is when used in a large sample, like when you're doing it with a team, it's a good indicator of future performance. Because we're saying, okay, like, you know, they're allowing these many fly balls, you know, as a percentage, then, you know, we can, especially as the weather heats up and, you know, balls are going to be flying a little bit more, especially at Petco when the marine layer burns off, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We can use that as just kind of a thing in the back of our mind. So their 440 expected FIP that they put up in the month of May as a team, I want to say it's like a 10th or 11th. So it's really not that crazy in terms of it's the 10th or 11th highest expected FIP. So they're in the bottom half of the league. On that. So, you know, they're putting up a lot of fly balls, allowing a lot of fly balls as a pitching staff, but not so many that it's like really concerning to the point where I'd be like, oh, like, you know, we need to really, you know, keep track of this. But if you want to look at kind of the why behind these performances, why the pitching staff was doing so well, I want to zoom in on one guy as a case study, Michael Wacha. I have a special place just from a positive replacement standpoint for Michael Wacha in my heart, because his episode, I think, performed like the weakest of all of the episodes. And it was because he got shelled like right before we released the episode. So no one wanted to watch this episode about Michael Wacha. But we were like, guys, I don't know, like the stuff behind like these numbers is not so bad. And then he goes on to have an insanely good month of May now. It's insanely good because it was pretty lucky in a lot of ways. He left 95% of his base runners on base, which is just simply unsustainable from a full season standpoint. He wasn't striking out a lot of guys, and he wasn't, his walk rate was like very kind of whatever, you know. He's 7.4% walk rate. Much higher than Yu Darvish, much lower than Blake Snell and Joe Musgrove. His expected FIP, you know, you want to talk about that dissonance between FIP and expected FIP. He had a 260 FIP. Amazing. Incredible. Take that. Run to the bank. Put it in the account. His expected FIP was 465. Okay. Not that good. You know, not terrible, but not that good. You look over, you just slide, if you're watching this on YouTube, look over to the left, there's a column right in the middle that says home runs per nine. He didn't allow any home runs in the month of May, okay? Now, that's awesome. That's good. But that's kind of what we were talking about with expected FIP earlier. Part of that is not up to him. Part of that is just the way the fly balls are flying in the month of May in Petco Park. You know, is that going to sustain? No, it's not going to. And when we scroll down a little bit and we look at Michael Wacha's stuff, this is a something that we've talked about in the show before. He's rolling out an absolutely terrible fastball. Okay, it is a stuff plus ranking of 72. That thing is straight as an arrow, and if you don't locate it correctly, it's going to get hit very hard. Now, Michael Wacha in the month of May has been locating it very well, and that's what's contributed to his success. But as John has talked about on the show, as we've mentioned many times over, pitchers on average miss their spot by somewhere around 13 inches on average. So I do not expect that Michael Wacha's fastball is going to solicit good results going forward. And I suspect that this is going to be kind of who Michael Wacha is for the whole year. He's going to be very streaky. When he's locating his pitch as well, he's going to put up numbers like this. When he's not, he's going to get absolutely bombed. He's not going to be like a pitcher like Blake Snell, where if he's not locating his stuff and he's walking a lot of guys, that's tough. But his stuff is so good that hitters aren't putting up good contact. You know, it's going to be Michael Wacha's like either getting shelled or he's not. And that's basically it. They're moving kind of to the staff as a whole. You know, we've talked about Stuff Plus before. It is a pitch modeling statistic that is relatively new. You know, I think we talk about it a lot in the Blake Snell episode because he is a Stuff Plus darling. So if you haven't gotten the read up on that, go ahead, watch the Blake Snell episode, pause this, we'll wait for you. You know, just looking at the team as a whole, the Stuff Plus king of the San Diego Padres right now, our five-star Uber driver, Steven Wilson. I mean, like, do you have anything? Do you have any annals you want to praise to about Steven Wilson? Because I'm looking at these numbers and it's like borderline incredible.
Yeah, I mean, ever since he moved to that sweeper, he's just been dominant, really. I mean, he's maybe not the guy you think of when you want, you know, a Padre to be pitching the eighth inning or so, but he's been getting the results of somebody who you would feel comfortable putting in like the seventh or eighth inning in a close game.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, so when we were comparing his stuff to the stuff of Yu Darvish, which, you know, unsurprisingly, Yu is another Stuff Plus darling and has, you know, four pitches that are considered above average by that pitching model, which is ridiculous. And he also throws two other pitches on top of that. And those are just two pitches that the model recognizes. I'm sure there's some other weird junk that he throws that, like, they don't even know what it is. So that therefore they can't model it. But Steven Wilson's fastball is a 135 Stuff Plus compared to Yu Darvish's 129. And Steven Wilson's slider is a 132 Stuff Plus compared to Yu Darvish's 138. Yu Darvish also started throwing a sweeper of sorts as well. So, you know, there's something to be said about Steven Wilson and the work that he's put in. I think, you know, when you have a guy that you can call on in the seventh, eighth inning, especially as he's a hard throwing righter with a tough sweeper leading into Josh Hader, who is, you know, obviously a very hard throwing lefty, and contrasting that, it's a good, you know, kind of 1-2 punch. And, you know, who knows if Robert Suarez is alive. Obviously, when he comes back, he'll be somewhere in that mix. This is a really silly, dumb tinfoil hat corner before I pass it back to you, John.
good.
But I'm really intrigued by Drew Carlton. Like, this is a guy who is like a quad A player who has jumped around a few major league organizations before, been up and, you know, down between AAA and the majors. He's only has 46 days of service time, so he's still a rookie, and, you know, he hasn't had significant time in the big leagues at all. But looking at the Stuff Plus model for him, he has three pitches that are above average. He has a 108 fastball, a 114 sinker, and a 107 slider, and a terrible changeup. But as a reliever, you know, he wouldn't need to throw that changeup at all. He could just cycle between the fastball, sinker, and the slider. And, you know, I think if he gets some more playing time, especially with our dearly departed Nabil Chrismat, you know, a smile for the ages, who apparently, you know, moved to a farm upstate, as I said on Thursday's pod for Padres Hot Tub, I think, you know, he could be the mop-up guy, and we could see maybe some excelling stuff from him. Really quickly, I want to talk about Ryan Weathers.
Hold on. Yeah, do you mind if
sorry,
I just bring up something on Drew Carlton? So you can just Google this. There's a YouTube video on Drew Carlton throwing a bullpen. You can just type in Drew Carlton bullpen, and it shows him working on his pitch shapes. So a question I have kind of in general is, which is the chicken and which is the egg? Like, is it that you can just know what these Stuff Plus models are and then try to get your pitch to look like that to make yourself money, which is just what I would do, or I feel like a lot of people would do. Like, if money is based on some kind of Stuff Plus model, which it seems as though it is, wouldn't you just want to make your pitches look like whatever's going to grade out high? And it seems like that's what he's doing. And, you know, we'll see as the league adjusts whether that just what they're all doing is making their pitches better, or if they're making it more similar to something that makes you money, but not necessarily as good as maybe you would think. But we'll see. It is funny, though, on that video, the Drew Carlton bullpen, it says, Drew Carlton throws a pretty good bullpen. It's like the least hype I've ever seen for a video. He throws a pretty good bullpen. But, I mean, we'll see. He definitely has been working on his pitch shapes, which I don't know how much our pitchers in general are doing that. It does seem like we're throwing more sweepers, which just in general tend to get you a higher Stuff Plus grade because of their outcomes. So that's just interesting to look at going forward is whether Drew Carlton maintains success. And if he doesn't maintain success, are his like Stuff Plus grades still good? And, you know, it's just basically that he was trying to manipulate the system to get more money, which I think is fair, by the way.
Really quickly on Ryan Weathers. I don't really trust him yet. You know, his numbers are interesting. He has, because he had a bad May. I would say he had an unlucky May. He had a good April. I would say he had a lucky April. The biggest thing, is that he has a home runs per nine rate of 0.81 on the year so far. And so compared to his career, when he has north of 1.5, you know, that's something that I suspect will potentially come to bite him going forward, especially as the weather warms up, like I said. You know, I definitely don't mind him as being the fifth starter right now, especially as we're seeing some attrition in the arm barn and in, you know, the Seth Lugo and now Luis Garcia going down a little bit. So, you know, I would just keep an eye on him. But I think it just goes back to we're starting to have a really good understanding of who Ryan Weathers is. And in terms of when he was coming up through the system, you know, Fangraphs, for instance, like they never pegged him as a starting pitcher. They pegged him as like a middle reliever. And I think we're starting to see that he is going to be kind of a swingman. You know, that's going to be his capability. You know, is that his ceiling? I don't know. He still has that elite pickoff move, which I love watching. But I would just keep an eye on Ryan Weathers and his home run rate as we progress through the season. Speaking of weird lefties, Tim Hill, John.
Tim Hill. What are we going to do with Tim Hill? One thing on Ryan Weathers before I get into Tim Hill is just that he is 23 and did make a lot of changes this offseason, which maybe suggests that he can continue to make changes as things go on. Yeah, currently his profile is not exciting to me, but, you know, a young pitcher that's willing to make adjustments, you know, he can do that Drew Carlton thing probably and suddenly have, you know, two or three pitches above that average mark. And maybe his success increases. We'll see. But Tim Hill, the curious case of Tim Hill, he is such a weird pitcher. We have a guy that we put into high leverage situations all the time who has, in the past 2 years, had a 4.69 and 5.40 Ks per nine, which is just remarkable. Like you never see that. You rarely see relievers with a K per nine under nine these days, and he's half of that, which means that we're basically putting a high leverage pitcher into these high leverage situations and at some point just hoping for good batted ball luck, which is not my favorite way to have a reliever come up, you know, especially in high leverage situations, because it's like he's just as likely to give up a hit to the Cincinnati Reds and blow a game as he is to, you know, pitch well against the Dodgers, which is, you know, I don't know from a strategic standpoint if that's good or whatever, but I know that it's concerning if you have a person coming in and are relying on batted ball luck in these high leverage situations, especially with runners on. I mean, if anything, with runners on, you want higher K rates so that they can't advance bases. But I don't know. He kind of reminds me of like Clay Meredith of back in the day, where it's like, I hope he gets a double play. But if he doesn't, I hope he doesn't give up four runs today. He is just like an okay pitcher, you know, but I really wish we were using him in lower leverage situations. I do think he's kind of just on the brink of, or on like the periphery of the roster. So we'll see. I don't think anybody is like super excited or angry at Tim Hill either way, but he's just so interesting to me to have such a low K rate reliever. And just speaking of the relievers in general, we obviously did a bunch of trades over the last couple of years, or AJ did. And one of the things that few people want, unless they're just nasty, nasty things or nasty, nasty pitchers, is relievers. So we actually have a lot of relievers that are coming up or making their way up, because we didn't trade very many relievers relative to the starting pitchers and kind of up the middle players that we did. So we have, for example, Alec Jacob, Angel Felipe, Jackson Wolf, Noel Vela, Garrett Hawkins, Ryan Burgert, Moises Lugo, Kevin Copps. These are all like, some of them are maybe starting pitchers that are more likely to transition into relief, and some of them are just straight up relievers. But this is a lot, a big cohort of kind of on the doorstep relief pitchers that hopefully now that we have paid, you know, Suarez, and we'll see if we pay Hader, we can kind of do that cheaper model of the bullpen, wherein you kind of shuffle people out, you give them rest, all of them are cheap, which allows you to maybe pay for more position players, which it seems like we already did. So hopefully that'll just keep our roster a little bit cheaper than it has been. It'll be interesting to see if we pay for Hader and just like have those two guys taking up most of our relief money, and then just shuffle in a bunch of lower cost guys. Cause like Cosgrove seems like he's probably going to stick around a while. He's obviously cheap. Steven Wilson's still cheap, and we'll see if Drew Carlton can maintain his talent. Brent Honeywell as well. Although there's some concerns, I think, that both you and I have seen with Brent Honeywell in terms of how good his stuff is performing, and like just batted ball luck, maybe not the most exciting pitcher on our team right now.
Yeah, and with that in mind, we're going to talk a little bit at the end of this episode about defense, because I was scrolling through Statcast, as I was saying in the episode, you know, just put different filters on, you know, stick, you know, whatever, and so I was going to defense, and I'm like, I wonder how I'm going to have to refine this to find something interesting about defense. I didn't have to. I just went to the outs above average leaderboard for the league, filtered by team, just to be like, hey, where do the Padres rank compared in outs above average compared to everyone else? We are demolishing the league in defense according to outs above average. Like, and I'm that's not like an exaggeration. We have 20 outs above average so far in 2023. The next highest team is the Brewers. They have 12. And then it's 10, 10, 10, 9, 8, 6. You know what I mean? Like, it's like we are so head and shoulders above the rest of the league in defense. We have 15 runs prevented compared to the next best team is 10. Okay. So this was a shock to me. I had no idea that we were doing so well. And if you look specifically on the slide of basically who are the breaking it down by player, who are the guys that are leading the way. Some things that are not surprising, you know, Ha-Seong Kim having a very solid year at second base, Manny Machado also being solid at third base, Trent Grisham, you know, he had kind of a rough April, but in May has been fantastic in center field. So, you know, he's back up. But there are two people that we need to talk about. Fernando Tatis Jr., who has put up 4 outs above average in, again, you know, 20 fewer games than everyone else. In right field, I believe he's leading the league or tied with the league lead in right field in terms of outs above average. And John, we got to talk about Xander Bogaerts' shortstop. this is a place that's maybe a sore subject for us in some way. You know, not sore in any sense. I mean, I'm thrilled. I am thrilled that so far we have been wrong, because before the season started, you know, we were sounding the alarm bells saying the Xander Bogaerts guy at shortstop, I don't know about him, because he had put up, you know, something like negative 36 outs above average in his career prior to 2022. And then in 2022, he had out of nowhere like a pretty good defensive year. And we were like, okay, you know, that might have been a blip, whatever. he's completely changed at shortstop. He's a completely different player. Mike Petriello on Twitter, you know, put out a great thread about him. I recommend you go check that out if you haven't. But what it basically boils down to is Xander was never someone who got the easy outs at shortstop. He actually was the most bitten by what we would consider routine plays. And routine plays are plays that have a 70% or higher likelihood of being completed for outs. In 2021, for instance, he had -8 outs above average. That is almost, runs prevented is, you know, in the infield, it's typically 3/4 of a run for every out above average. So that's six runs prevented. So more than half of a win just lost in 2021 to the Red Sox on Xander's defense against routine plays. In 2022, that number changed to 5 in the plus column. So that's a 13, outs above average swing. And that pattern has continued in 2023. In 2023, he has 6 outs above average on the easy ones, which is fantastic. And then, you know, in the harder ones, any plays that have a lower than 70% probability of completion, he, again, 2021, -3 outs above average. 2022, 0. So, you know, which is fine if you're making all the easy ones, if you're having an average output on the hard ones, that's okay if you're excelling on the easy ones. In 2023, he has 2 outs above average on the harder ones. And that's the thing that, you know, I think we've talked about on the show, you know, Xander Bogaerts' arm has not gotten any stronger. And so for plays that are in the hole where he's moving to his right, I was expecting him to not be performing well at all. This year he has 3 outs above average on move to the player's right. So, I don't know. Do we need to issue some sort of official apology, John? Like, are you feeling that, you know, this is just small sample size? Like, what do you make of all of this?
So before or after the 2022 season, he was asked about his defense. And one of the things that he said that he did was work on charging the ball a little bit more, which makes sense when you have a weak arm. Like, you don't want to wait on a ball. You want to attack it as soon as you can so that your body weight's going towards first base and the distance is shorter. So I would wonder whether prior to 2022, he was just kind of letting balls get to him and then letting his weak arm allow easy outs to not be outs because he's, you know, trying to rifle it across and it's just people are able to outrun it. So it does sound as though he understands a little bit of the, you know, strategies that he needs to employ in order to make himself better. Another question I have just in general is how Jake Cronenworth, who's only been, one ounce above average in the field so far, how much is he helping basically everybody on the infield because he has had so few poor plays in terms of receiving the ball? You know, like that play that he had the other day where Ha-Sung Kim didn't catch the ball and he thought he caught it and then he threw it over to first and Jake Cronenworth just wasn't there. If Jake Cronenworth was there, you're going to give Ha-Sung Kim an entire out above average, like higher than he actually has right now, no matter what the percentage of the play was. And so Jake Cronenworth making picks, he can get an entire out above average just on a good pick that, you know, Hosmer might have like walked behind a runner on. And so I do wonder, you know, just if there's any kind of analysis on what Jake Cronenworth is providing to specific players. I know that he's, you know, the picking metrics are what they are, but he's just been very good over there at first base. And I wonder if he's, you know, Xander charging balls plus a first baseman that's, you know, really good at picking them is able to kind of slowly move his numbers up and up as he makes all the routine plays. Making all the routine plays is going to make you a good shortstop.
Yeah. Yeah. So the last thing that we want to talk about is Fernando Tatis's play in the outfield, which has been exceptional. And, you know, John and I were reviewing some video prior to recording of some of the catches that StatCast rates as being difficult for the average outfielder. There was one in particular that we'll show on screen right now when the Padres were playing the Red Sox in San Diego, and he caught a ball that Alex Verdugo hit into the right center field gap. And, you know, when you watch the play, it seems sort of unremarkable. You know, it's a ball that he runs down, and certainly it was on the run. You're like, oh, okay, good play. But he gets under it. Like, he's actually decelerating, like, when he's catching the ball because he's already gotten there. Whereas, you know, some folks might have to be, you know, continuing to run and dive, you know, whatever. That play that you just watched has a 30% catch probability. And to me, that is a microcosm of exactly what makes Fernando Tatis Jr. so exceptional in the outfield. We're going to put on screen his StatCast outfielder jump statistics. And for this year, you can see that if you look at components of jump, that middle part, his reaction has been above average. You know, it's been a half second or a half foot, above average, which has been, you know, that's fine. You know, it's in the red. It's not anything amazing. What makes him great is his burst. And the burst is the part where you see someone's speed start to take over. And where if you have a really athletic outfielder, for instance, it starts to come to the surface. And you can see his 2.3 feet above average in the burst shows you exactly what makes Fernando Tatis good. He's really fast and he can get under those balls in a great amount of time. So his 3.1 feet above average in right field in terms of jump, which is taking all those components of jump and adding them together, is, you know, it's all world. It's something that is the same reason why some people think he may make a good center fielder someday. Which let's compare his numbers to Trent Grisham's numbers, and we can start to see what separates Trent Grisham from Fernando Tatis Jr. and what makes them both good outfielders in different respects. You know, I pointed out the burst column for Fernando Tatis Jr. in terms of his outfielder jump. For Trent Grisham, it's the reaction column. So even in 2023, which is kind of like not his greatest year so far because he had a little bit of a tough April in the outfield, his reaction is 1.4 feet above average, which is still solidly in that, you know, that solid red you can see. That means he's very high compared to the rest of the league, whereas his burst is a more pedestrian 0.5 feet above average, okay? And, you know, you compare that to Tatis, who has 0.5 feet above average on reaction but 2.3 feet above average on burst. You can start to see how these players are very different. They're both good, but in different ways. The other thing that I would point out is that if you look on the left side of the jump column stats, Tatis is outs above average on two star or greater plays. These are plays that have a 90% or lower catch probability. He's making 76.2% of those plays. He has four outs above average on them. And you compare that to Trent Grisham, who again is a very good center fielder. So far in this year, he's only converting 65.2% of those plays, and he only has one out above average. So, you know, that is basically where we're seeing Fernando Tatis Jr. excel, is he's getting and accumulating that value on low probability plays. And, you know, that is paying dividends for him going forward. John, any thoughts on Tatis? Do you think he's a future center fielder? Do you think he's going to be just an elite right fielder? What do you think?
I think he could be elite at either. I do want to just mention that he doesn't get any outs above average on his arm, and mm-hmm. he has provided outs above average on his arm. So you're not even counting those towards his statistics, and he has done a great job nailing people, especially at third base, but at home too, and, you know, throwing nearly 100 miles an hour from that right field spot. But I do wonder, because we do have this question, especially with our offensive utility, do we move him to center field so that we can get a corner outfielder with a more prototypical corner outfield or bat profile? And looking at this positional versatility article, I do wonder whether the answer is not both, i.e. getting Tatis to be able to play center field as well as right field, and then kind of hunting matchups with the corner outfielder versus, you know, and center fielder. Because if you can put Trent Grisham into opportunities, especially against like low K rate pitchers, pitchers that are a little bit more wild, obviously right-handed pitchers in general, maybe with lower velo, I bet you could, you know, spike his offensive profile while also, you know, having his, what has in a large sample size been shown to be a good defensive profile, you know, while also maybe having a right-handed bat that you can put in, maybe a right-handed bat who's particularly good against velocity, just basically the exact things that Trent Grisham struggles against, and then put them in right field. And move Tatis over to center, because that versatility is something that our roster should have. It just doesn't. And so I do wonder whether, like, at the trading deadline, especially if you didn't have two roster spots on DH, if you could have at least one of those, like, DH-type hitters be a right-handed hitter who plays right field, are you know, an old Nelson Cruz, like an older, old, like, you know, 2018 Nelson Cruz, who could actually, like, sit out there once in a while. I just think that would provide a lot of value for our team as a whole. So it will be interesting to see whether he at least gets opportunities in center field, whether he's a center fielder or a right fielder. Maybe the answer is both.
Well, with that in mind, John, looks like our, just like my therapist tells me, it looks like our time has come to a close. That's going to be it for this episode of Pods Above Replacement. We hope you've enjoyed us. Again, please like, comment, and subscribe to our videos. Join our Patreon, patreon.com/PadresHotTub. That's where we're having tons of conversations with other Padres Hot Tub patrons. For as low as $5 a month, you can join our Discord. You know, we're on that Pods Above Replacement channel constantly, as we've said many times on the show. And, you know, download that YouTube Music app. Check out our podcast as a YouTube podcast. See what it does for you. I'm going to start doing it myself for some of my other shows. It's free. It's free. Exactly. Nothing to lose on that one. So for John Prokota, I'm Rafe Cantor. This has been another episode of Pods Above Replacement, and we will see you next time.